Well, today is a day on which the people of Sydney are breathing smoke from fires that represent an early start to the fire season. And in the words of 24 former fire and emergency chiefs, quote, climate change is making bushfires deadlier and the bushfire season longer. Just a 1% rise has meant the extremes are far more extreme. Yet we know that if we don't meet those Paris targets, the prospect of your children, grandchildren, living in a world that's 4% warmer is distinctly possible. In my little book, Run for Your Life, I speculated, out last year, I speculated that in 2050, I might be living in a retirement home, in a tower. All of the east coast of Australia would be towers, of course, at that time, while outside the air was full of smoke, all our national parks were chronically subject to fire. There was no fire season. Fires burnt all the time. And our bush supported little or no life. In the centre of Australia, an area as big as a European nation was now unlivable. This is my dystopia, Australia in 2050. All the ecological zones we grew up with have shifted all over the place, scattering flora and fauna, trying to find some remnants of the cool, of the wet, but without success. Well, we're deeply honoured to have Ross Garnaut here today. He brings with him a substantial record as an economist, ambassador, advisor to governments, author of that key report, 2008, the Garnaut Climate Report. While finishing this book, he was touring with Jane, his wife, the Murray Darling, where he saw, he says, unarguable evidence that climate change is now here upon us. And he said, and I quote, climate change in the Murray Darling is reproducing the fate of the Tigris and Euphrates several thousand years ago, when the riverways evaporated into today's Iraqi deserts. Well, Ross, that's a vivid way to open a book which might otherwise have been, for some people, a little dry, a little challenging, grappling with the policy and particularly the economic challenges.
Well, it was a gripping scene that we experienced up there, Darling. It's country that Jane and I have visited before. It was where her dad grew up, on the Lower Darling, and beautiful country. There's majestic river gums on both banks, but normally on other times water between it, but now white sand beneath it with an occasional stagnant pool with a big skeleton of a Murray cod alongside the stagnant pool where it had been ravished by wild pigs who were able to capture the survivor of 80 summers and a dozen droughts. So that was in my mind as I wrote that introductory chapter.
And you're careful when you talk about that to say there have been conditions like this before, drought conditions before, but these conditions are becoming more frequent and more severe, which is a concept that we can apply to much of the evidence of climate change, like the bushfires, for example.
Yes, I, of course, have no background in the science of climate change, so I relied on the people who study these things. And in my 2008 report, I reported on likely consequences of unmitigated climate change, and regrettably, the atmospheric physics of 2007 and 2008 was very sound, and events were unfolding just as the best scientists of Australia and of the world were saying that it would.
You spoke very eloquently at the commemoration for the late Bob Hawke in the middle of the year, presided over by Craig Emerson, who's with us tonight, a friend and advisor to Hawke and later a minister. And I remember that was on a Friday. I remember the Saturday after, I was at lunchtime with the former Victorian Premier, Steve Brax, and we went into that Sri Lankan restaurant just off William Street, and we bumped into you. And we congratulated you on your commemoration to Hawke. By the way, you praised Hawke for, among other things, his commitment to evidence-based policy. You look at the evidence, you form a policy. And you use cabinet processes to get at that policy. But you had one message for Brax and me. You said, Australia can get to that 45% reduction in emissions by 2030 by allowing the pricing and investment decision to continue to move forward. And that was a very optimistic message. For someone now working in the area of business and climate, it was almost a credo for me, and I've been quoting it in every speech I've given since. Please tell me you, I'm not paraphrasing you, I haven't overstated the case, and you still think that we could get there.
Well, I said that to you and to Steve, Bob, because I'd seen stuff in the paper about you backtracking from it. Labor Party had just been through that cruel election result, and some people were saying that it was the outcome was partly the consequence of having gone too far on climate. I was firmly of the view, and I've continued to follow these things very closely, that the Labor Party targets were not difficult to meet. In fact, they would be met along the way of implementing what was in the best interests of the Australian economy. So it didn't require an impossible effort or even a difficult effort. Yes, that is true. It's true even though we're now bound to live with policies that are not supportive of the climate transition, at least at the federal level. I would not have thought this outcome likely when I did my first report or my second one. And what has changed is that it's become much less costly to make the transition, especially in this country with our exceptional endowments of renewable energy and opportunities for capturing carbon in the landscape.
Yeah. Well, let's just underline that. This goal you see as being feasible because the cost of implementing it has fallen dramatically since you grappled with the issue in the 2008 report.
Yes, and I can't hide from my errors because I wrote 696 pages embodying the very detailed modelling that I did. The first climate change review was commissioned by the states with an invitation for the Commonwealth to join. The Commonwealth joined when Kevin Rudd became Prime Minister at the end of 2007. So I was working with all the resources of the treasuries, as it happened, of Victoria and Queensland, and the Commonwealth Treasury and the best academic modelling groups in Australia. We did the most detailed, long-dated modelling of the Australian economy that's been attempted before then or since. And when you do that sort of modelling, you've got to make your explicit assumptions about what's going to happen to various costs. Our group consulted with the best people working on technology and science and also making the equipment for renewable energy. And in Australia, in Japan, in Korea, in China, in Germany, in Britain, in the United States. We wrote into all of that modelling an expectation that the cost for a couple of decades of solar power would fall by a few percent per annum. Well, in fact, in the decade after we put that work to bed, costs fell by 85%, very much more rapidly than we, doing our best on the best advice, presumed at the time.
And a bonus as well, and as an economist, you're fully able to capture this, the fall, and you say it's going to be a long-term fall, in the cost of money.
in interest rates.
That's an historic change that makes a lot of difference to a lot of things. It's a change that I talked about in my book Dog Days, published in 2013, where I foresaw the half a dozen years of bumping along the bottom and no growth in incomes, which sadly we have experienced. But there's been a big change in the relationship between savings and income and investment and income in the world as a whole. A tendency for people to save more and invest less, which has led to capital markets pricing capital more cheaply, a reduction in real interest rates. Now, 7 or 8 years of steady economic growth in the United States and unemployment at historically low levels, real interest rates set in the markets, not by central banks, 10-year bonds, 20-year bonds, real interest rates of approximately zero. That has a huge effect on the cost of the energy transition, because nearly all of the costs of renewable energy and storage of energy are capital. The cost of fossil energy or electricity from fossil energy is, to a considerable extent, the cost of mining year by year the coal or the natural gas. The operating costs are a very high proportion of total costs, but for renewable energy the costs are overwhelmingly the cost of capital. So a reduction of real interest rates to near zero greatly reduces the cost of renewable energy. That reduces the cost of the necessary transition. It improves the competitiveness of zero emissions energy relative to coal and gas-based energy.
Yeah, there was one qualification you attached to your optimism, though, when you said to Brax and me, we can get there, the country can get to a 45% reduction in emissions by 2030. I think you thought about it for a moment, then you quickly pressed the qualification, and again, I hope I'm not misquoting you in paraphrasing, providing the government is not drawn to subsidise coal.
Yeah, you're remembering it very accurately.
Thanks.
Because
I've quoted that 100 times since and attributed it to you. I might have heard back from you if it had been a serious mistake.
Of course, part of the story of the energy markets in recent years has been the overhanging risk that the government will subsidise coal. I noticed that Jason Falinski, a member for one of the Sydney electorates in the federal parliament for the Liberal Party, said in Q&A with me the other night that no, we would never think of that, but. Well, maybe I heard wrong or read wrong, but I have read statements attributed to the Minister for Resources and other leading figures of the government saying that this was being contemplated. Well, maybe I just heard and read wrong.
Yeah. On page 10, you say, quote, it will become clear throughout the 2020s that drawing 50% of electricity from renewable sources is simply a milestone on the path to more comprehensive transformation.
Yeah.
And that's powerful and it's optimistic. But I think the essence of your book is summarised with this sentence, and that's when you say, the advantage of the low-carbon world are great for Australia. That if we're making, the whole globe is committed to this transformation, zero net emissions by 2050 that so many countries have committed to, this is going to be a world that offers great advantages to this carbon-based nation of ours.
Yeah, and it's a little bit paradoxical because we are the world's biggest exporter of coal and the world's biggest exporter of LNG as of this month, having, I think, surpassed Qatar. We've done well in incomes and jobs and export revenue from coal and gas and from industries based on them. We've had advantages. Those advantages for a long time gave us relatively low-cost energy that supported energy-intensive industries. The aluminium industry that developed in Gladstone in Queensland, in Newcastle, in Portland, in Victoria, after Japan, for environmental reasons, effectively shut down its aluminium industry in the 80s. So the energy in the coal and gas economy provided a lot of economic advantages for Australia. But these advantages were limited in their effects on the competitiveness of energy-using industries because these commodities are tradable. A steelmaker in Kobe in Japan can get metallurgical coal from Newcastle or Mackay a bit more cheaply than Andrew Forrest seeking to turn his iron ore into steel could get it for use in the Pilbara in Western Australia. We used to have very big advantages in the cost of natural gas. So when we didn't have an export industry, we had very cheap, the cheapest natural gas in the developed world, and a lot of our manufacturing of plastics and petrochemicals, especially based in Melbourne, Geelong and Adelaide, was based on that low-cost gas. But that advantage disappeared when we internationalised the gas market, and we went from having gas prices one-third of the United States to having gas prices three times the United States because the US adopted the opposite policy of restricting exports of gas. So we lost any advantage that we used to have exporting, through our coal and LNG becoming part of a global market. Now, I'm not against globalization of energy markets, but the consequence was that we lost any competitive advantage from that source. But we won't lose the competitive advantage when renewable energy, zero emissions energy, is everyone's source of energy, because we've got distinctively the world's best combinations of renewable energy. We've got the lowest cost wind and solar resources in the world, the best combinations. In southern Australia, particularly strong with wind, exceptionally good, but a lot of the locations are very good for solar. As you go north towards Capricorn, the solar becomes as good as any in the world, and the wind's still not too bad. At the moment, the growth of zero emissions energy in the world is wind and solar. So we've got the resources of the energy sources that are important. Later, other sources of zero emissions energy will probably become more important in particular locations. These will include probably tidal and wave, and we've actually got exceptionally good resources for them as well. And we won't lose the competitive advantage in these renewable energy sources because these are not so readily exportable. You can build a high-voltage transmission line underwater and take a long way. We've done that between Tasmania and Victoria. In today's Financial Review, there was talk of doing that between Darwin and Singapore and between the Pilbara and Java, and that may very well happen.
You are a bit cautious about that because on page 110, you say renewable energy can be traded internationally only at high cost.
That's right.
Cautionary warning, saying international transmission of electricity from Australia would cost much more than the electricity itself. Your argument is that the renewables offer colossal savings used on Australian soil.
Yes, and that's the point. Whereas Australian metallurgical coal is no more expensive if you use it in Kobe than if you use it in Australia, Australian renewable energy will be much more expensive if you use it in Kobe or in Singapore.
So what did you tell Michael Cannon Brooks when you had dinner with him last night? Did you warn him to be careful about his economics as he proposes this high voltage line from Northern Australia?
Well, he's just committed to a $15 billion investment, I'm all in favour of giving it a go, and I think that will be part of the future. But the bigger opportunity for Australia is to use that at home. There's two main ways that you can transport renewable energy internationally. One is a high voltage cable. Very expensive, probably costs probably half the value of the electricity in Java or in Singapore is the cost of the cable. So it's half the cost if you use it here. The other vehicle is hydrogen, either using renewable energy to make hydrogen, either liquefying it and exporting it like we export LNG, or turning it into ammonia where you don't have to liquefy it. You've got another process with more costs, but it's cheaper to transport. Well, hydrogen's hard to liquefy, harder than LNG. It doesn't liquefy till nearly absolute zero. Absolute zero is the point at which electrons stop vibrating. Chief Scientist Alan Finkel told me that about 6 months ago. And it takes a hell of a lot of pressure to get anywhere near absolute zero. And so you use half the energy in the hydrogen to liquefy it. Mm. And hydrogen's the smallest of molecules, H2. And H, of course, the smallest of atoms. And it seeps out between the molecules of steel. And so you've got to have special containers, special materials to contain it. It's expensive to transport. So it just won't be economic to take Australian hydrogen to Japan and Australian iron ore to Japan and then to turn it into iron metal there. It'll be much cheaper to do it here. So the advantages of having low-cost energy are going to be much more important as an advantage for industrial activity in the zero-emissions economy than it was in the fossil energy economy.
Yeah, so you give one example of it, and that is of what happens here on Australian soil as the world moves closer to insisting on zero emission steel. So we've witnessed the loss of our steel industry in recent decades. I was premier when integrated steelmaking ended in Newcastle. It was a trauma for the Hunter and for the whole state. But you see an opportunity for steelmaking, you say, on a, quote, immense scale, unquote, in the Pilbara, in the Upper Spencer Gulf. You see iron production migrating to Australia from industrial Asia because Korea and Japan have got a weak endowment of renewable energy resources. And we could even get a proportion of Chinese capacity, even though China's got colossal renewables. But I just wonder what scale of a environmental catastrophe it would take to see Japan and Korea and to some extent China, get out of steelmaking and to allow those industries to migrate to Australia because we can do it with renewables?
Well, we're talking about the early stages of steelmaking, not turning it into machine goods or Mercedes-Benzes.
Okay.
And so Germany keeps all of that value added and Japan keeps all the value added of a Komatsu truck and a Toyota car, it will be difficult for them to remain competitive for the later stage steelmaking if they have to make zero emissions iron with their own resources. Mm. I chair an institution called the Australian-Germany Energy Transition Hub, which a number of Australian universities based at Melbourne, a number of Australian universities are part of, and five major universities and research institutes in Germany, and with very close interaction with German industry and German government. And it's really interesting interacting with Europe on these issues because there it's not argued, it's just understood that they will have to be operating with zero emissions in a couple of decades' time. They expect European policy to require it, and by Europe I can include the UK in this, whatever is happening in Brexit, because British thinking is similar to continental European thinking on this matter. And so their mind is going to, well, how do we remain competitive in all those metal products, downstream products? And they know that they will reach limits of turning their own renewable energy resources into a base for industry. They're already reaching limits in Germany on the land that people will tolerate to be used for solar and wind. They're going to have to import a lot more energy. They look around the world and they can see that the low-cost way of importing iron or aluminium or silicon for their computing industries and photovoltaic panel industries may very well be the import of materials made with renewable energy in Australia. In the case of iron, Australia is by far the biggest exporter of iron oxide, iron ore, for the world's steel industry. China makes half of the world's steel, and Australia supplies 70% of China's iron ore. The quantities here are immense. Global steelmaking is responsible for 7% of global emissions, and Australian iron ore, not responsible for, won't use that word, but generates 3% of global emissions. That's nearly three times as much as the emissions of everything we do in Australia when coal is added to it. Somewhere in the world, that iron oxide is going to be turned into iron metal through a zero emissions process. From what we know now, the low cost path will be the use of hydrogen, which can be made from renewable energy. The exhaust from reduction of iron oxide using H2O is water, whereas the exhaust from using coal is CO2. We can do a little bit more water in our atmosphere. Unfortunately, it won't be all that much. But
these are strong commitments by Germany and Japan. They're taking reaching zero emissions so seriously that you think there's a chance of them relocating basic steelmaking to Australia with its renewables, where it will be a zero emissions process. I'd love to have an evening without mentioning Donald Trump. But are you a bit worried that with America walking out of Paris in November next year, a lot of the world, Japan, Europe, might think, China, why should we make sacrifices in adhering to these Paris targets? They do involve a lot of hard decisions, restructuring and the rest. When the United States, the world's biggest economy, is just saying, we're out of it.
Well, I'm worried about American policy under Trump for what it might do to the global commitment on climate change. I'm even more worried on the climate change issue for what they're doing to the trading system, because the other way that Germany or Japan or may deal with the problem is to say, okay, it will cost a lot for us to use very expensive, low-quality renewable resources here to make iron and steel, and we'll just keep imports of anything that uses iron and steel out. This is already coming up in discussions with European industry and European governments. The idea of a border tax on imports from countries which don't have strong climate policies. The idea there is that if a German steelmaker is required to have zero emissions in steel, if someone tries to bring in a product with steel in it that's been made with high emissions, then there'll be a tax at the border. The answer to that 4 years ago would have been, well, that's inconsistent with the international community's commitments on free trade under the WTO. What they say now, and I heard it in a conference with our German colleagues a couple of months ago, is Donald Trump's blown up the WTO. We can do what's best for climate now, and that will be a border tax. If that was done in a way that systematically favoured low emissions imports of iron over high emissions, that would be all right for us. But the trouble with protectionism has become very political and pretty crude, and pretty soon there'd be some German interest saying, oh, well, let's not take a risk on steel from anywhere, and it becomes a general protection. And that would make the world effort on moving to zero emissions much harder. We need global commitment on the goal of zero emissions by the middle of the century, no later, But we also need open trade globally if we're going to make this at reasonable cost.
Yeah. Let me just test you on the proposition of Australia as an energy superpower in a post-carbon world. I'll throw a word out there. You give me one or two sentences to explain what the word might mean in that equation. So let's begin with ammonia.
Yeah. Ammonia is a very important commodity in world agriculture and world trade. Now, some of the consequences of using large amounts of it are actually ecologically a bit unfortunate, but it's been an important... Nitrogen fertilizers have been an important part of the growth of agricultural output around the world in the past 50 years. Well, I suppose the last 100 years since Haber and Bosch in Germany invented the process to capture nitrogen in a chemical that can be put in the ground for fertilizers. The other big use of ammonia is explosives. We're a big user of that in our mines. About 16.5 million tons a year traded, exported of ammonia. At the moment, ammonia is one of the most emissions-intensive industries. You take natural gas, you could take coal. Originally in Europe you used coal, but now it's more natural gas. You extract the carbon, a carbon monoxide from the hydrocarbon of the coal or gas. You combine that with the nitrogen in the atmosphere under great heat and pressure, using a lot of energy, and you release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and embody the nitrogen in a compound. It can be ammonia, it can be taken another stage into urea, another compound. This is a big industry globally. We've got some of it in Australia, but based on gas and coal. But you can make ammonia through renewable processes. There's two essential ingredients. You need hydrogen, which you can make from gas and release carbon dioxide. Or you can make hydrogen by running electricity through water, splitting it into the hydrogen and the oxygen, releasing the oxygen. That does no damage. And then taking the hydrogen, combining that with nitrogen from the atmosphere under heat and pressure, and the heat and pressure can come from renewable energy. So you've got zero emissions ammonia. And that can be used in agriculture, for explosives. It's a big commodity.
So a new industry for Australia.
Yeah, well, we've got some ammonia now based on gas, but renewable. And it's an industry where we'll have distinctive advantages, whereas we don't have special advantages in today's world.
Yeah. Hydrogen.
Hydrogen is a source of energy. You can use hydrogen in place of natural gas for all the things that the natural gas does for energy. You can transport it through pipes into people's homes. Electricity probably might be cheaper than doing that, but you can use hydrogen. You can use it instead of gas for peaking power generation, if you've got a lot of solar and wind, for when the sun's not shining enough and the wind's not blowing enough. You can use the peaking hydrogen instead of peaking gas. But you can also use its chemical properties to reduce metals. And I've given the big example. Steel is the big industrial source of carbon dioxide emissions, and hydrogen can replace coke. It can replace coal in taking the oxygen atoms out of iron. There's been more discussion in Australia so far in Alan Finkel's important work on building the hydrogen economy, our chief scientist. He's done a report, and he's going to building another report on that. A lot of the state governments have taken that up, hydrogen strategy. There's been more focus on hydrogen as a source of energy. I think more transformatively important for Australia will be for its chemical properties, including as the element that takes the oxygen out of iron oxide to make iron.
Okay, biomass.
Yeah. all of our chemical industries, all of our petrochemical industries, our plastics industries, a lot of our materials industries are based on oil, gas, or coal. The hydrocarbon properties, the combinations of carbon and hydrogen in those fossil deposits are then used as a base for manufacturing. It's the chemical properties that are used. Now, the normal industrial processes release large amounts of carbon dioxide. If you want to still have products that serve the purposes of plastics and a wide range of other chemical manufacturers, you need to start with a hydrocarbon. Now, what coal and oil and gas are the remnants of plants, mostly plants, but plants and animals, organic creatures that lived billions of or hundreds of millions of years ago. We can short-circuit that process and take material from plants that are living now. And that's what biomass is. It's the living hydrocarbons that, processed in a slightly different way, can form a base for the same sorts of chemical industries that coal and gas are now the base of.
Yeah, one part of that, I think this is the correct way of putting it, is something that this university's got a specialty in. And I was briefed yesterday from Peter Rolfe, Professor of Science here, about microalgae.
Yeah.
And it sounds very exciting. You mentioned algae in three spaces in the book, because when he was briefing me, we rifled the tome. And the focus is microalgae. And the US has a number of algae farms making omega-3 food supplements.
Yep.
But microalgae as a basis for producing, as a substitute for the carbon currently used to produce plastics or clothing or protein, sounds very exciting.
Yeah, and it's using recently living plants rather than plants that lived hundreds of millions of years ago, and we're extracting the same chemical properties. And algae is really interesting. Now, I don't talk as much about them in chapter 7 of this book as on the is in the corresponding chapters of the previous book, and that's not because I downgrade the importance of that. I actually say more about land-based carbon opportunities and biomass opportunities in this book. But algae's got some remarkable properties. It's, first of all, it's the original source of negative emissions. This Earth was formed with a carbonic atmosphere in which life like us had no chance of living, with lots of carbon dioxide and no oxygen. And algae got to work, and over hundreds of millions, one of my biochemist colleagues, when I said hundreds of millions, said or billions of years, took through the process of photosynthesis, sunlight and absorption of carbon from the atmosphere, turned it into a hydrocarbon, released the oxygen into the air, captured the carbon from carbon dioxide, released the oxygen, and that created the oxygen-rich atmosphere in which mammals can live. The algae does that more efficiently than any other plant. It's the original source of photosynthesis. It existed before any land-based plants. And the data I've seen suggests that it's eight times as efficient in converting sunlight into hydrocarbons as any land-based plant. It's got a long track record. It's good at it. It's proven it can do it. The challenge will be to harvest it from salt water at low cost. A lot of the research is going into efficient ways of harvesting.
Yep. Now, your book bursts with discussion of these ideas. There's also a big, serious chapter on what we need to do to fix up our electricity system. We call it the electricity transformation. And the challenge seems to be that we've got all this renewable capacity, but it's testing the resilience of the grid.
Yeah.
And I even speculate that you could have a consensus industry policy, a consensus climate policy emerge in Canberra with both sides competing with ideas to render more resilient, more robust the grid, to get all these renewables diversely located across Australia, the wind and the solar, industrial strength, to get them to the consumers. You've got lots of ideas for fixing up the grid, for transforming interconnectors, batteries, and all the rest. What do you think, though, not of the technical arguments, but the fact that the possibility that this could now be the debate, surging renewables coming down in price dramatically? We really need Canberra to come out with competing ideas for seeing we've got a grid that can get them to customers, store them as required, get them between the states.
Well, just at the moment, that looks a dream. As you see in the book, I'm taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And I think we've got an example, South Australia. South Australia, the Labor government there of Jay Weatherill, had an objective of having 50% renewable energy by 2025. Now, they made rapid progress on that, not so much because of policy, although they were favourably inclined in regulatory ways to the industry, so made it easy, and that helped. But the big reasons why South Australia moved much faster than other states was you had the same incentives from the Commonwealth, the renewable energy target, and for a couple of years carbon pricing, exactly the same in every state. But South Australia had much weaker, much more expensive, lower quality coal than New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland. And so the old energy economy was more expensive and less secure in South Australia for that reason. But also the combinations of solar and wind are pretty good in South Australia, better than Sydney and Melbourne. And so the old energy was more expensive than the other states and less reliable. Also, at the end of the grid doesn't help reliability. The new energy was better in South Australia than in the heavily settled parts of New South Wales and Victoria. And so things went very quickly. You had that an event I discuss in the book, an extraordinary episode of the blackout, the statewide blackout, due to an extreme weather event in 2016, September 2016. One could interpret what happened in a different way. You had a cyclonic event in a non-cyclonic state, unprecedented weather event. Unprecedented severity of lightning strikes, which took out a lot of the infrastructure, stronger winds than you'd ever had, which knocked down 23 transmission towers. But that did lead to, in a cascading effect, to the collapse of the power system. It took hours to get it going again in Adelaide, and in the outlying areas, the Eyre Peninsula, took days. It was a very serious episode. That need not have happened. It happened in South Australia, I think, because the regulatory agencies that were set up when we created the national energy market, you were probably part of it, the states used to have complete responsibility in these areas, and they ceded responsibility to a federal body, COAG, which chaired by the Commonwealth, but with the states participating there. And the regulatory agencies never took seriously the many adjustments that have to be made to make the system work when you have a high proportion of renewable energy. They did not look to the future. Well, the blackout led to looking to the future. The South Australian government responded very quickly. We got the big battery as a result of that, and a number of other adjustments. As a result of that, South Australia now has more secure power than New South Wales and Victoria, and for the first time ever, on a consistent basis, it's a bit cheaper than Victorian power. At first, the coalition attacked the Labor government for that, but what has happened since the Marshall government came in, they've embraced it. And
a coalition government in South Australia is the apostle for renewable power.
They are proud of it, and in two important ways have extended the policy supporting it. So there you do have an example of once people realised the extent of the opportunity, you did get the two major political parties competing for who could manage this transition best.
And one part of it should be greater demand management, and that's an area where the Institute of Sustainable Futures has developed a considerable specialty. You'd endorse the notion that we can do a whole lot more in managing demand in a way that relieves pressure on the rather stressed grid.
Yes, it's an underdeveloped area in Australia and with immense opportunities, and it's relevant at the household and small business level as well as at the big industrial level. The costs of most of the costs of the grid are to service demand for a few hours a year, and those high peaks on a hot summer's afternoon when everyone comes home and turns their air conditioning on. And similarly, a lot of the generation capacity is there to service limited peaks. Yeah. So if you can provide incentives for people to use less power at the peaks, or at least draw less power from the grid at the peaks, you can greatly reduce the cost of the system. You can do that with household or small business batteries, so that filling up with solar during the day and then running off the battery during the peak periods. The electric car provides a huge opportunity for that, so long as you provide the incentives for people to plug in at off-peak times. Of course, you make the problem worse if you provide no incentives to take demand away from the peak. People will come home from work and plug in the electric car at the same time as they turn on the air conditioner. That would make things worse, but it could be made a lot better. At the industrial level, there's immense opportunities. 10 to 12% of the electricity used in New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria is in big aluminium smelters. Well, you can turn them off for an hour in 20, even with current technology, without damaging them.
Big contribution to demand management.
And that is a big contribution. But with engineering, with demand management in mind, you can extend the amount of time where they can operate at less than full capacity. Hydrogen's got a very big role in demand management. If hydrogen becomes a big source of demand, an electrolyzer can turn off like that in a millisecond, and you just leave it off for as long as the grid is under stress. So the development of hydrogen is going to be to make an important contribution to demand management.
Percy Allen, the former head of New South Wales Treasury, had something to say on behalf of himself and colleagues in the last few days on Australia's disappointing performance with evidence-based policy, a point you made in your earlier book. Can we really say that we're a smart people, smart nation? Is the evidence getting a bit frayed for us to be able to make that kind of boast?
Well, if we were genetically of below average intelligence, then we would have always been underperforming, and we haven't always underperformed. We're underperforming at the moment.
Okay.
But we've had our good points.
Okay.
I suppose I had the unusual good fortune of working closely with Bob Hawke, but I think that period of government showed that we need not be dumb.
We had two nights ago here in the Great Hall, we had a discussion with Martin Parkinson, senior public servant, being asked questions by Marion Wilkinson, an author and journalist, and we ended up pretty depressed because we were dealing with the failure of attempts over 10 years, to implement the Garnaut Climate Report, to have a trading system that simply, elegantly put a price on carbon and saw the transformation take place incrementally but fairly rapidly. You're giving us a more positive message tonight. You're talking about the prospect that this country could be a superpower in the post-carbon world. So on the bottom line, answer candidly, are you today an optimist or a pessimist?
I think there's immense opportunity. It's there for us to grasp. We would have to continue to make mistakes of the magnitude of the last 6 years. And
to get this wrong.
Okay. Not to be the superpower. The prize is Australian employment growth, high employment, rising incomes instead of the stagnant incomes we've had for the last half dozen years. We're still a democratic political system. There's lots of corruption of our communication systems and our media, but despite all that, I think our democracy is still capable of choosing an outcome that is overwhelmingly better for Australians than the alternative. And that's the question. Am I optimistic about the Australian democracy allowing Australians to choose something that's demonstrably better for them, not only for the environmental and climate reasons, but economically? Yes, I am an optimist on that, but I don't think it's certain. I think it is possible we could still muck it up.
Okay.